This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, our guest is the Chief Test Pilot for Honeywell Aerospace. In the news, we look at the 737-700 freighters, folding wingtips for the 777X, and an online general aviation community from the European Aviation Safety Agency. Also, student pilot Nikki and an interview from the Planes of Fame air show. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 504 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first Brian Coleman. He's our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. Hope everything's well tonight. Looking forward to a fun, interesting show.
Yeah, this is going to be very interesting, I think. And to help us ensure that it's very interesting, we have David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hi, David.
Hi. I'm here to fact check like I heard about last week.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we kind of went, well, I kind of went off at the end of the last episode. We heard from some listeners. Glad to have you back, David. You're feeling much better, I hope?
I am. Glad to be back.
Good. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the year. He's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Max West, how are you?
I am great. Back from two flights earlier today and four on Sunday, and you know how it goes. I mean, it's happy to get a break from all that flying and come here and talk to you people.
Max, how many hours do you have?
Ooh, it's around 10,000.
Really? Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Amazing.
All of it within 1 mile of the airport. No, not really.
Our guest this episode is Joe Duval. He's chief test pilot and site leader for Honeywell Aerospace flight test operations at Sky Harbor in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, Honeywell Aerospace produces a really wide variety of components and systems for just about everything, general aviation, business aviation, commercial, military aircraft, as well as for space applications. And that includes avionics and engine controls, APUs, propulsion engines, including those from the legacy companies, Garrett and Lycoming. Now, Joe's responsible for all flight test engineering efforts, development and strategy, and maintaining technical and programmatic excellence across a team of engineers and technicians, mechanics, and pilots. Now, he pilots Honeywell's Boeing 757 and Convair 580 aircraft, and he also participates in flight tests on other aircraft that are in Honeywell's fleet. Before joining Honeywell, Joe served as a research and test pilot with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Lincoln Laboratory Flight Facility. He also served in the United States Air Force as a pilot on the C-130 in the Boeing 707 VIP aircraft. Joe is still working to catch up to Trescott. He has over 7,000 hours of flying time as a pilot and flight engineer in multiple aircraft. He holds FAA type ratings in 8 aircraft. He has a Bachelor's of Science from Oregon State University in software engineering. He's Honeywell's corporate point of contact for the Society of Experimental Test Pilots. Joe also attended the National Test Pilot School in Mojave, California. He's a graduate of Southern California Safety Institute's Flight Safety Officer course. Joe, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hi, guys. Glad to be here from sunny Phoenix, Arizona this evening.
Oh, wonderful. Now, Joe, was becoming a test pilot your personal goal, or was it just being a pilot and becoming a test pilot sort of presented itself along the way? How did that work?
Yeah, I think it was just being a pilot. And then, as you said, it kind of presented itself along the way. I didn't start out thinking I wanted to be a test pilot. I was like a lot of kids staring up in the sky and pointing at airplanes and decided I want to fly them. And like you said, you mentioned, I went into the Air Force and things happened. And yeah, here I end up tripped over a couple of the right rocks, I guess.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to talk with Joe about the kinds of things that he does as a test pilot for Honeywell. We have a lot of exciting things, I think, to talk about. But first, we're going to start with a little bit of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready. Ready from the West.
Ready.
Our first story comes from Airline Reporter. This is Alaska Airlines' new 737-700 freighters provide, quote, lifeline for many Alaska communities. Okay, Brian, I have this recollection of you suggesting, maybe not suggesting, maybe stating flatly that the, the 737-700 MAX didn't really have a real good purpose in life. Well, what have we learned from this article?
Well, we learned that I say really stupid things sometimes, and I'm wrong, and I admit it. And this is definitely one of them because, yeah, I was not a fan of the 700, really didn't see a purpose for it. And here Alaska comes, and with the cargo capacity of the aircraft, really turns into what seems like an essential aircraft for an awful lot of Alaskan communities and airfields. So it seems like it can take off and land on much shorter runways and carry a whole heck of a lot more cargo than the, I guess, what will soon be retired, the 400 series, the classics. So Alaska has some combis and some dedicated freighters, and it looks like the 700 is going to fit that mission perfectly.
Yeah, right. You mentioned their fleet of Dash 400 aircraft and their high cycle aircraft nearing the end of their life. So we have here conversion of some Dash 700 next gen aircraft to freighters, and I think that's usually the case. I think most freighters start out life as something else and then go through a conversion process, oftentimes later into their lifespan, but not always the case. Sometimes, as we see here, you have new aircraft that are that undergo that conversion process. And one thing about these aircraft is that's mentioned in the article, of course, is retaining fleet commonality. That's something that Alaska Airlines would, as any airline, would find valuable in terms of training and process procedures and all of that. So, the Dash 700 lives on in Alaska anyway.
Yeah, and I think one of the other stats that I found really interesting is they say that they fly the aircraft 10 and a half hours a day, and they're averaging 6.7 daily cycles. So, on the one hand, I thought, well, 10 and a half hours out of a day isn't very much. But then when you think about all the time that they have to load and unload the aircraft, I guess they really are getting good efficiency out of the aircraft.
Yeah, it does sound like really high utilization.
Yeah.
And if you don't know any better, it's a bus stop. I mean, for a lot of if you've ever flown into Canada, Alaska, those Kodiak and Juneau and some of the smaller airports, literally this is their lifeline into that town, like Ketchikan. And you literally hop up to Anchorage from Seattle. My one flight home from Ketchikan actually was on a 200 combi. Got to sit in the back of the airplane with all the cargo up front.
Wow.
So that was kind of a cool way, and a brand new airplane designed with the capabilities of a normal 787-800 with all of the special avionics that Alaska has, because it's not necessarily the best environment to fly in. It's a good commonality that they've gone through and added the freighters to it, because for a lot of Alaskans, the airplane is their lifeline.
For sure. Joe, have you ever done any northern flying, cold weather flying, or any bush flying, anything like that in your history?
I have out of Anchorage. Nothing that these guys would be doing on a regular basis than these into those smaller communities and things. But I did get to do some C-130 flying up there, where we did some low-level flying around some of the, through the mountains and some of the glacier fields and things. And then the funny thing is we'd end up at the end of the low-level flight, we'd end up just right next to, it was Elmendorf Air Force Base right next to Anchorage. And then there's a drop zone right next to that where we'd go fly for a couple of hours out over the ice. And then come and drop the troops right there next to where we took off. But I haven't been into those a lot of those little airports. And you know, Alaska's been a leader in some of these. You know, you mentioned all the avionics that those new airplanes will have. They've been a leader in using some of that stuff and requiring some of that required navigation performance things and up in that area that really allow them to get in and out of those airports when the weather's not as good as it, you know, not very good. It can get pretty foggy and things with all the winters up there. So yeah, sure. It's pretty interesting that they're able to use this new airplane with the, like you mentioned, all the performance it's got, and it's a purpose-built cargo plane. So it really seems like it found a niche for its existence.
It's interesting how certain aircraft can sometimes just fall into certain roles or certain types of missions. Sometimes they're planned like that from, you know, the inception of the aircraft. But there are other times when just circumstances come to pass that allow certain aircraft either to become popular or to become useful in some missions and others not so much. It's sort of one of the risks of, you know, when you're designing aircraft, trying to anticipate the uses, the value that they can provide. Well, let's talk about this next item. This is also concerning Boeing, but in this case, it's the 777X, and this is from Engadget. Boeing's folding wingtips get the FAA green light. Now, the 777X has a pretty extensive wingspan, 235 feet. Just by comparison, the 747-8 has a 224-foot wingspan, so it's even smaller than on a 777X. Of course, the A380 is got the large wingspan, 262 feet, and of course for the A380, some airports had to install or build new gates in order to accommodate that aircraft. Well, with the 777X wings being so broad, there's also a problem with them fitting into some airports. And so Boeing has designed a solution, and that being folding wingtips. And the FAA has just approved Boeing's solution here by issuing what they call it special conditions. Folding wingtips, David, I mean, that's something that we see in naval aircraft, of course, all the time. I'm not sure I can think of too many commercial airplanes that have folding wings.
At least not intentionally.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Not, and it's really not just because of the gates. It's because some of the taxiways at various airports are narrower. The wings actually are going to fold up immediately upon landing. So it's not like you're going to get to the gate and they're going to fold up. They're going to be fold up on taxiing back to the gate. And I remember talking about this years ago, and a lot of my co-hosts and other people were really upset that civilian airplanes were going to have flying wings. And I kept going, we've been folding wings for years. And this is a pretty straightforward, just goes up 90 degrees fold. So I can't wait for the 777X test like they did with the F-14, where one wing is folded in flight and the other wing is straight out like it should be. There have been a lot of aircraft like Phantoms and F-8s that wings have folded in flight and the aircraft still flew. Funny how that works. So good for the FAA, and I'm glad Boeing has got this solution because they've wanted this for years now. The original 777s were going to have folding wings, but they couldn't sell it to people.
Yeah, David, when I first heard about this, I thought that the wing was going to fold something more like a Corsair would fold its wing, or maybe halfway down the wing. I didn't realize that it was just the wing tip. So it's interesting that there's not that much of the wing that's actually folding.
No, when it's folded, it looks kind of like winglets that you'd
like
see
a winglet.
On other aircraft. Yeah,
expect they would leave it folded in flight for the winglet type benefit. I mean, it's really odd, but you're right. With them sticking straight up, it's hard to know that they're not winglets instead of folded up wingtips.
Yeah,
and you don't think they did that on purpose? If you don't know any better, do you think that if you were walking out to the airplane and you saw it sitting at the gate, I think Boeing did that on purpose.
Oh, you mean so not to spook passengers?
Yeah, this is a good point. I didn't think of that either, but that's a good point.
They could have folded it flat, like they do on other aircraft, but like a Viking or something. But they folded it 90 degrees, so it looks like a winglet. And I'm 99% sure that was intentional, so it looks like a winglet. Hmm. And the odds are most people won't notice them folding down as they get to the end of the runway.
Hmm. Well, one aspect of this whole story is that the applicable airworthiness regulations didn't include safety standards required for this type of a design feature. And the FAA says these special conditions contain the added safety standards that the FAA considers necessary to establish a level of safety equivalent to that established by the existing airworthiness standards. So what are these special conditions? Well, reading from the FAA statement here, Boeing has determined that a catastrophic event could occur if the model 777-8 and -9 airplane wingtips are not properly positioned and secured for takeoff and during flight. They say that for these special conditions, a parallel is drawn between taking off with gust locks engaged and taking off with the wingtips folded, as either condition could result in a catastrophic event. Consequently, the FAA has determined that the level of safety in protecting a misconfigured airplane from takeoff with wingtips folded should be the same as taking off with the gust locks engaged. Therefore, the condition for these special conditions is the same as what's applicable for gust locks. The applicant, that being Boeing, must show that such an event is extremely improbable, not impossible, extremely improbable, must not result from a single failure, in that appropriate alerting must be provided for the crew to manage unsafe system operating conditions. In addition, the applicant, again Boeing, must ensure that the wingtips are properly secured during ground operations to protect ground personnel against bodily injury. And then there's some other things too. The FAA talks about wingtip position lights, right? Those are normally on the wingtips. You fold the wingtips up. What's the implication there? They're also concerned about wind gusts and how that might impact the aircraft. And then there's some structural considerations. But we'll put a video in the show notes from Boeing, titled Boeing 777X Folding Wingtips, that kind of gives you a good perspective of this. And this is an interesting process, I found anyway, where, you know, the manufacturer, Boeing, comes up with this modification, and the FAA says, well, we don't have anything that governs that, and so they have this process for accommodating that with these special conditions.
Boy, as you said, level of safety for gust locks, I was thinking, you know, there have been a lot of accidents in general aviation, and, you know, some moderate-sized planes where they've tried to take off with gust locks on and, you know, destroyed the airplane and killed people on board. So when I think of gust locks being installed, I can't think of anything that equates with level of safety. It's just darn dangerous. So I'm wondering, Joe, are there gust locks in something like the 757? And if so, what kind of warnings do you get if they're still in on takeoff?
No, there's no, you know, I flew 707s and I've 727s and some other models, and that size airplane doesn't have gust locks as you used to in, you know, in business and general aviation airplanes and like. They have other things, snubbers and things that are incorporated into the flight control system that, you know, kind of effectively do the same. In other words, that if a gust of wind or something came along while the airplane's parked, it's not going to do damage to the airplane or the flight controls or things like that. So they've incorporated that into the flight control system. So I see this not so much like you're saying as the gust control. I see them, you know, just it was also kind of mentioned the configuration warning. So even in airplane in the 707 and all the way through the 757 and on, there are configuration warnings that if you're out in the taking off and you push the power up for takeoff, if certain things aren't set correctly, there's warnings that would go off in the cockpit. And I can see it kind of working in that same regard, as well as landing. I mean, you know, even the smaller airplanes, if you have a retractable gear, and for instance, you don't put the gear down and you do something with the throttles or do something that would be, you know, like you're approaching to land and you haven't got the gear down, you get some kind of a light and a horn or something that goes off. So I can see it being, you know, similar application in that regard. And I think you mentioned it, but it's kind of automatic, right? Somebody mentioned the wings tips will fold up automatically when you land. And I guess I don't know how they're going to extend, but, you know, there would be something like you set the flaps for takeoff maybe and the wing tips, you know, extend or something. I don't know how it's going to work exactly, but I could imagine it being something like that. And I too, I'm very interested in watching the flight testing that they'll do to prove this system out, obviously, because it's new and they had to get the FAA on board, and they'll be looking at the safety of the systems, and I'm sure they'll do a great job. But I'm sure there'll be, you know, a lot of different tests that they'll do to prove the safety of the system and safety of the airplane. And it'll have hundreds or a thousand hours and, like, you know, cycles and everything on it before it's given a green light, I guess you'd say, to
sure
be a production airplane. So yeah, it's exciting to watch.
Yes, it is. It is, Joe. When Boeing is flight testing something like this, or when you at Honeywell are flight testing an engine on the 757 test aircraft, for example, what are the regulatory aspects that you know allow the flight of aircraft like that?
Well, you can imagine that a lot of times, you mentioned our engine on the 757. It's the only airplane with one of those on it. So
right.
there isn't really a precedent so specific to that, you know, installation. You know, and like this, the wingtip, I imagine what will happen, and this is what we do here. We at Honeywell, we have a good relationship with our FAA, or the regional folks that govern what we do, and we approach them with a process by which we're going to prove the safety of this installation. So there's a lot of things. I mean, it takes months, if not years, to get something like that approved and tested out. And once we do get to flying something, there'll be, I guess the way to put it maybe would be to say we're going to take baby steps. So we just flew for the first time. We flew a turboprop on our 757. And in doing that, you know, this was the first time anybody had put one on the side of an airplane like this. So we had one, we did install one on our previous test bed, but it's the first time on our 757. So we certainly had a lot of analysis and a lot of design and a lot of, you know, fluid modeling. I mean, just a lot of engineering and design and things that go into the process. And then we were very alert to the risks that may happen, you know. So we were going to approach this with slower airspeeds and lower altitudes, and just make sure that the handling characteristics of the airplane were as expected. And then we would gradually increase that envelope. You know, we would go to slightly higher airspeeds and slightly higher altitude, maybe up to some limits, something that we need to get to for the testing. So we just approach it with a kind of a baby step approach, mitigate as many of the risks as we can so it's not a safety issue.
Right.
And then we come back, we take one flight, and come back and look at all the data and maybe make a tweak or two and go and do it again and expand the, you know, get a little bit faster, a little bit higher until we're comfortable with how the airplane operates and how the test engine operates, of course, and that we can, you know, feel like we can control it properly, and it's just like we'd hoped.
So, Joe, does Honeywell in effect deliver to the FAA the test plan, the flight test plan that includes all the analysis and the things you talked about, and then the FAA grants you authority to fly that plan? Is that how that works?
If we go back to when we first got the 757. And we said we're going to attach this any kind of test engine and go, you know, we're going to make this large modification and go do this. Yeah, that was the kind of the back and forth. There was a lot of analysis from the inspection side on the FAA. They have a lot of smart people that were helping us. You know, we have a plan, and then they would kind of they could help us, you know, adjust the plan or tweak the plan. We were restricted in, you know, different airspace, you know, just until it's kind of proven that it works. So they helped us a lot of ways in that regard. And yeah, eventually we could show to them that what we, you know, kind of, we had kind of a hypothesis, I guess you could say, of how it was going to work and how fast or how well the plane was going to handle. And we proved that that was the case. And so we got some data back to them, and they allow us to go continue to flight test engines with this configuration.
All right, good.
Yeah. So it's a good, you know, it's a good relationship, and you have to have a good relationship with their, like I say, the local, the people that govern, the local regional FAA folks that govern what we do.
Yes, for sure. All right. We're going to talk more about that in just a second. But first, we wanted to mention, and this is from AIN Online, that the European Aviation Safety Agency has created a webpage for general aviation operators. Now, they say, quote, "This platform is for GA enthusiasts to meet and share their passion. Keep yourself updated and share the latest news and events." They have a number of sections in this site. There's a section where you can get a general overview on GA matters. There's an events section to plan and discover GA events. There's a section they call topics where you can, they say, dive deeper into discussions on specific GA matters. And then there's a members area where you can engage and connect with members of the GA community. Max T, was this something that had been anticipated, or what do you think about EASA's move here?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I didn't think that, like most large regulatory agencies, they paid a whole lot of attention to general aviation. So, I mean, that kind of surprised me. I had not heard of it. It's relatively small at this point. They currently have 136 members signed onto the website. I did actually sign up onto it last night as a member, and I guess it's not strictly for folks in Europe, because when I was asked to select my time zone, I could pick Los Angeles.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, I think it's kind of a nice move. It'll be interesting to see, you know, to what extent the general aviation pilots embrace the whole concept.
Yeah, I think it's, if I take a look at some of the postings here, you know, there's a question posted about the instrument rating, you know, something about EASA's annual safety conference. So I'm sure it's going to be a good way for people to share information about flying and general aviation in Europe.
Yeah.
The first thing I thought of as a U.S. pilot, I was kind of hoping that maybe it would be a place that I could go, and if I were to find myself in Europe, maybe I could learn, or maybe it would be there'd be links on there to learn a little about what it would take for me to maybe rent a plane or something over there. And I had looked into that before, but I just kind of was, That was the first thing that I kind of hoped. Maybe that'll become, you know, a topic on there. Anyway, that's the first thing I thought of. I know there are some U.S. registered airplanes that people maintain over there that as a U.S. registered pilot, I can fly. I think if you try as a U.S. registered pilot to fly a European registered airplane, you have to have some kind of either a U.S. or a European license or some kind of a...
You need the conversion license, they call it. I was just researching that last night for Australia because I'm looking to see if I could get one. And oh my gosh, you should see the length of the application form. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think that would be a really useful addition to that site. I hope maybe they'll consider adding that.
I think there's already information out there available, but certainly a link or one of the topics or sections, I guess, maybe of the website.
Yeah, yeah. Again, we're speaking with Joe Duval, Honeywell test pilot. Joe, again, thanks for coming on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, when it comes to becoming a test pilot, I see that you attended the National Test Pilot School. What does it take to become a test pilot? Do you have to go to school? Do you have to be certificated as a test pilot? How does that work?
You don't have to be certificated. I think quite honestly, you need to have the interest of being kind of a little bit of an engineering mindset, maybe, and still, of course, want to fly airplanes and want to have that interest of helping develop new and exciting and safety-related products. And so the test pilot school does offer certifications, and there are, in other parts of the world, there are flight test certifications you can gain or apply for and get, but the U.S. doesn't require it.
Are there any tests that you have to go through to confirm that you're crazy to be a test pilot? And
That's one way to put it.
Brian. Oh, my God.
And I think that's kind of a common perception, isn't it, that somehow test pilots are doing something inherently risky. But don't you really work to eliminate all the risk? I mean, in some ways, I think you're probably more disciplined than other pilots.
Yeah, I think I have a little matrix I made, you know, what my mom thinks I do, what my boss thinks I do, what, you know, what I really do. And yeah, there's exactly that. You've seen the movie The Right Stuff, or you've seen interesting things about testing new and really, you know, unique or weird planes and things that, you know, either maybe went well or didn't go well. But we do take a very close look at all the risks of what we're doing, and spend a lot more time on the ground. It's probably of almost three to one in sense of how much planning and things that we do for every hour of flying. There's probably, you know, 3 hours of planning, and a lot of that is mitigating all those risks and figuring out how we can do things and not put ourselves in some kind of a, you know, a sticky situation.
Well, Joe, when does the, you know, the flight test organization become involved in a program? Is it from the very beginning, or at what point do the guys who are dreaming up these ideas start to talk to you?
Yeah, ideally, it would happen in the beginning of time, but that's not always how it happens, because we don't always maybe know that something needs to be flight tested. You know, products can kind of morph into something that somebody didn't really envision them to be at the beginning of time. If it's engines, what we've been talking about, there's an FAR, there's a FAA regulations that describe what needs to be done and what needs to be tested. And there are other, you know, operational tests that are prescribed for certain surveillance kinds of things that we do. But like I say, ideally we get involved early, because we can be part of the planning. We need to maybe plan to modify an airplane to support the test. And there's a lot of things that would help if we're involved early. But we also, you know, somebody finally might realize that we need to test something, and we have to kind of be reactive enough to support that within the company. We also get involved in, you know, in-service issues, or when there's modifications to certain equipment, if they make a new version of a product or something. So we'll need to go out and flight test that and make sure it's working. So there's quite a variety of ranges of when we get involved. We're always going to be there at the end of that kind of process, just so that we're making sure that the system's working well and make sure it's a robust product for before Honeywell sets it out to the public or sets it out to the airlines and whomever's going to buy it. So it's a robust product.
Mm. Have there ever been occasions where through this process, you and the flight test organization has had to make some recommendations back to the project team based on, you know, what you expect might or might not happen in testing?
Yeah, we find ourselves in that position quite often.
Huh.
You can't always anticipate, I guess, what's going to happen once you put something on an airplane. And also, if you know, somebody's great idea may not be that useful, or may not work that well once you do put it in an airplane. So there's another number of things that we might find, the bench testing that somebody might do to, you know, make some product, you know, go through some scripts or what have you. To try to get it ready to put on an airplane. I guess what I'm trying to say is they may have a very scripted way of testing it.
Mm.
And it's not as dynamic as the environment that we're going to expose it to once we put it on an airplane and get it out into the airspace. I was testing something for a product that was going to go on a military plane, and the engineers thought they had an issue with the system every time they got to a certain mileage from the airport. So they would have this script where they flew this simulation, basically, and every time they got to 10 miles or whatever it was, I forget what it was, they saw this anomaly. So the script was very good, because it was a computer at taking off and then, you know, getting to a certain altitude at that same 10 miles.
Hmm.
So I went and helped them evaluate this, and I said, well, let me just fly this thing, and so we took off from the— and it's just a bench. I mean, it's just a simulation, but I took off from the same airport, and I didn't get quite as high at the same mileage figure that they did, that the script did. And then, you know, the anomaly didn't occur at the same distance. So we were able to quickly figure out that it was actually the altitude that was affecting it, and not the mileage.
Interesting.
You know, and you can imagine if, you know, you get down a path a little bit and people don't, maybe you can't, without a fresh set of eyes looking at it, with a fresh mind, sometimes it's, you know, it's difficult to see outside of the, of where you've gotten yourself down this path. So we see that quite often in many different ways about, you know, having an ability to recommend some changes and some tweaks here and there, and, you know, what pilots might really want instead of what the engineers might think they want. And, you know, there's a lot of those things.
Now, maybe we should describe these aircraft a little bit. We can start with the 757. So, of course, when you're testing an engine on the 757, you're not replacing one of the two engines on the 757. You right. have a pylon, I guess you would call it, that extends from the upper part of the fuselage, right?
Yes. Yes, and we do call it a pylon, yeah. And you're right. The main engines on the 757 are about 40,000 pounds of thrust each. And the jet engines that we're making at Honeywell are in the neighborhood of 7,000 pounds, let's say. So, you know, roughly a sixth of the power. So we're not expecting the little engine to push the big airplane around. We do have, there's a bit of a joke in that we have this trailing cone that comes out of the back, and it looks like we might have the trolling motor there when we put out the fishing line. But no, we don't expect that the little engine is going to be part of the airplane's propulsion. And that's all by design. When we talk about why we, if you wanted to talk about why we chose the airplane and all that stuff, that's all by design, that we want and need really an airplane with the performance of a 757, because we need to take that little engine up to 40 or 45,000 feet even sometimes, and then have a consistent airspeed and be able to maintain that altitude while that engine is being, put through its paces. In other words, if you had that engine as part of the propulsion that you were depending on, if you got up that high, you wouldn't stay there very long if you had to put that one engine at idle and it was part of what was, moving the airplane along.
Now, I haven't seen a photo of the Convair, the 340 that you use as well. Does that also have a pylon, or is that used for a different kind of testing?
That's used for different kind of testing. It's a Convair 580, which means that it's one of those 340s or 440s that have been modified with the turboprop engines and some other things. So it was purchased because we were developing predictive wind shear, which is the system that alerts the pilots, especially when you're down, in a landing or takeoff down near an airport in the terminal area, that there's potential for wind shear in the area, which can be a bad place to be. You don't want to get into the wind shear. So we were developing that, and we needed an airplane that was rugged enough to actually get into wind shear and, be able to go through it and survive. As I said, we try to mitigate all the risks. So what we have there is an airplane that has with the big turboprops and a big straight wing. It's got a lot of performance at low airspeeds and low altitude. So it's something that we could, what we have to do is when we were developing this, is we have to go to an area where there is this wind shear and then actually prove that it was there. So we actually had to fly through the wind shear and take data to, to show that what we predicted was actually there. Mm. Now, most of the airplanes, I've talked about how dangerous it is. And most of the times these airplanes that are, you don't want to encounter it when you're approaching the airport and you're kind of at your, relatively slowest speed so that you can make the landing, or if you just were taking off and you're heavy and you're, again, slow speeds, you don't want to encounter this wind shear event. So what we do is we mitigate the risk by not being at such a slow speed or such a heavy weight, and we can safely, get into that wind shear and go right through it.
You have the margin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we give ourselves that performance margin so that we're not doing anything foolish. So the Convair does that, and it does a lot of other tests with the weather, so not only the weather radar, but transponder things, TCAS, ground proximity warning systems, which is our terrain warning systems, and a variety of other things. It's a great airplane.
When you're testing avionics or electronics, things like that, what is the setup? I mean, obviously the aircraft has its own version of the avionics or whatever. So I imagine you set up a parallel system in order to test it. Is that in the cockpit, or is that being tested in the back of the aircraft by technicians? How do you test things like avionics?
Yeah, sometimes it's a parallel. Sometimes it might have to be the thing that we're also depending on. And we may, it just depends on what airplane it's in and what we're designing it for. But yeah, we're in general, though, the installation that we make of this unit, this thing, this product, is going to have some method of acquiring data off of it as we're doing the test. So it's going to be a little bit different than the normal installation, because we're going to be recording data from it somehow. Maybe there's we can imagine there's a laptop computer that's plugged into it, or maybe it's got its own data card, an SD card or something inside that's, and a program runs on it that collects the data onto the card. There's a variety of ways to do that, but that's the main difference. And if it is something that we're relying on, then we're going to take other risk mitigation measures by, for instance, making sure that it's a clear weather day and it's during the day and we're in a, not a very populated airspace, something like that, that, make sure that the pilots have their full attention and can see how the system is working.
You know, with all this kind of activity going on, to me, it feels like your day-to-day responsibilities, activities are probably somewhat variable. It doesn't sound like you have the kind of job where it's the same old thing every day.
Yeah, that's you're right. And that's one thing I really enjoy about the job, is that it is, variable. It's not the same old thing. And we have about 5 or 6 airplanes here at my site, and there's just a lot of different things that'll be going on with them any day of the week. A lot of the programs take quite a while. As I mentioned, we spend quite a bit of time on the ground to kind of develop the flight test profile and get the product installed and get that data acquisition system working, like I was mentioning. So there's quite a lot of work going in, day to day before we go fly.
What are some of the other aircraft that Honeywell has in the test fleet?
So at my site here, we talked about the 757, and we have the Convair. We also have a Citation 5 that does some cockpit avionics, flight management system, and other screens and data, or other screens and things like that, testing. We have 2 King Air aircraft, and we have a new integrated cockpit system that it's called AeroView, that we're producing, that we can demonstrate in those King Airs. We have up at the other site, we have Pilatus PC-12, we have a Falcon 900, there's an Embraer 170, we have a helicopter, we have an AS-350, and I think that's about it. I'm trying to count right now, but I think that's about it.
How are these maintained? Does Honeywell have its own maintenance department, or do you outsource that sort of thing?
Yeah, we have our own maintenance department. I have there's about 25 people that work at my site here in support of the airplanes. There's pilots, obviously, and then there's the mechanics we just mentioned. There's a whole engineering group that helps design and then modify the airplanes with these things that we're testing. But yeah, we try to do as much as the maintenance as we can in house. All of our airplanes are a little bit unique. They're so we kind of know them best, maybe is a way to put it. We know what's been changed and modified. And we do, like in the 757, there are major inspections that come along every few years that we'll have to take the airplane somewhere else, just because there's so much to do. It would take us quite a long time with the small team of people we have to do it. Mm. So we'll take them to a repair center, maintenance center for, take a month or so to maybe get through, a month and a half. But yeah, we try to maintain them all ourselves. We have a great group of mechanics.
Yeah, that's nice to have all that right there. But you probably also need that kind of skill set, I can imagine, when you have to reconfigure aircraft all the time. You need people with those kinds of talents, I would think.
Yeah, the mechanics that work for us really are kind of an engineering mechanic. They get to, I'll say, work closely with the engineers to see how they can design this new installation. I mean, we have some great sheet metal guys, for instance, that they're just almost visionaries in the way that they can design an installation. And the engineer wants to put something on an airplane, it has to be physically mounted. So they'll work with our sheet metal guy, and they figure out how the installation will work best. And the same thing with the electronics folks. We have to, if you can imagine some avionics box in the back of the airplane, it has to be powered. It has to get some data from the airplane, that whether it might be airspeed or altitude, things like that. And then And then, like I was mentioning before, we have to acquire some data off of it. So that all has to be wired in and tested and you know, maintained for the life of the program that we, as long as we have that thing installed on the airplane. So, yeah, it's a unique job for the pilots. It's also a unique job for the mechanics and the engineers, just pretty much everybody that's involved. I think we all like our job.
That's exciting. Max T, yeah. Do you ever think that you'd like to be a test pilot?
You know, that's a fascinating question. I think the kind of the aerodynamics and the engineering side of it would definitely have a huge appeal to me. So, yeah, it's possible. Joe mentioned kind of 3-to-1, you know, in terms of time spent preparing for each flight. I'd rather be more like, you know, 1-to-1. more time in the air, less time on the ground preparing. So,
Max T, that's why you're so far ahead of me on the hours.
Yeah. Well,
and actually, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah. We still get enough hours that we go out in training flights and as well, and you know, those don't take the kind of time. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's, you know, I think one of the most exciting things we do is when we have a new product that we get to develop and or be a part of the development. And,
yeah,
you know, get it installed and get it going. So that's that kind of ties it all together, where it's something different and something new to look forward to. It's great.
And you've mentioned a new turboprop that you've been testing lately.
Well, it's the same turboprop that we've been making for a while. It's just the first time that we've installed it on the 757.
Ah.
Just new to us right now, new to the airplane.
So are you doing some tests that you weren't able to do in the past without a test aircraft like that?
No, not exactly. Quite honestly, we started out with turboprops. So as far as flight tests, we've had a flight test operation for over 50 years here, and it was started with the turboprop, the TPE 331. They had old bombers. They had bomber and attack A-36 airplanes. We've had the Boeing 720, and those all had turboprops mounted on them. This is just the first time we've had an opportunity to put a turboprop on the 757 and kind of prove out the capability that we have there with it. We've only done jet engines on the 757 until now.
Yes. Yeah, one of the things that we seem to be talking about here a lot lately is electric propulsion. Do you think someday you may find yourself testing an electric engine?
Well, you know, I think anything's possible. Honeywell's been a part of the aerospace industry for over a century, and we've got a long history of developing cutting-edge technology and pretty much anything from the front to the back of the airplane. We were just a big part of the recent Uber Elevate Summit. In fact, we were a platinum sponsor. And so I think that there's a lot of capability in our products, and we'll probably be a part of that space in the future.
Yeah, that was very interesting. In fact, for those of you listening, the Aviation Week Check 6 podcast, the episode that's out now, had a conversation about the Uber Elevate conference. And they had someone from Uber talking about sort of the aviation aspects. That was really kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
We talk about the, you know, autonomous air taxis and all of these things, but there really is some serious conversation going on in the industry.
Yeah, I think so too. It's, you know, if you think about the Jetsons or something, I mean, people have been thinking about these things for quite a while, but I think that's the right comment, that there's certainly a lot more serious conversations going on about it now.
Yeah.
Certainly the technology is advancing to make it more realistic.
And I think there are going to be a few winners and probably a whole lot of losers. I think right now there's so much money flowing into that space. Everybody would like to be the next, flying car manufacturer. But I think there's going to be one heck of a shakeout in a few years, and a lot of money is going to get lost.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see how that all works out. It'll be exciting to watch.
Yeah.
Max, is this when we promote our new show, the Flying Taxi podcast? Occurs on Friday mornings.
Yeah. Sometimes topic area becomes so dominant that we end up spinning off a podcast just on that topic. And yeah, this is kind of building towards that.
Though in this case, most of that's still speculative. I mean, there's nothing that's really out there, you know, finished and being sold. So to me, that's when it's going to get really interesting, is when, you know, products start shipping.
Yes, for
sure. So can we talk about some real flying, like special operations flying and 130 flying and 137 flying?
See, Joe, the C-130 is David's favorite airplane. Or if it's not the favorite, it's pretty close.
C-130 is quite possibly the most capable aircraft in the United States Air Force inventory. I've never said that before.
Well, to be honest, my father was base civil engineer for the 913th here at Willow Grove. So I grew up around 130. So that's why it's my favorite airplane. But it's a fabulous four-engine fighter. But what was it like flying the 137s and 135s?
Well, so that's always a fun story. Well, to me it is because I started out flying the C-130 and, you know, it's as you said, four fans of freedom. It's got a very robust and capable airplane, but it's not a high flying fast jet. So the 137 that I flew was an EC-137. It was just a modified civilian Boeing 707. In fact, you guys were talking about combis earlier. This was a combi. So it had a cargo door in the front and you could put cargo in the front. We had seats up there. And it was an executive transport airplane with a nice bedroom suite, and we had a nice galley. We carried flight attendants that could make 5-star meals, and it was just a really comfortable way to fly. But I remember one of the first times just being in the simulator and watching the ground speed and seeing how fast and how high we were climbing. I was like, wow, I think I finally made it. It was a lot of fun. The C-130 was some of the greatest times were being down low in a formation, maybe doing something over some mountainous terrain and making our way along the terrain to some drop zone. Of course, there were four people in the cockpit. There were two pilots and a flight engineer and then a navigator, and everybody's working together. And it was quite poetic, you could almost say, when it was working well. Everybody's working well together. We got the beams and bullets to the ground and got the guys and the troops and everybody where they needed to go on time. That was, a really special kind of mission. And then the 707 flying was quite different, where we were taking generals and other members of delegations from Congress or what have you around the world, and maybe a little more going to a little more of the garden spots of the world than the C-130 took me.
Great experiences. What did you learn most from the C-130 experience, let's say, that sort of carried through your career up to this point?
I think there was a lot of camaraderie, and there was also, I want to say, friendly competition in that the pilots and the flight engineers, I remember challenging each other on, all the specific knowledge about the airplane. Hmm. And, knowing exactly the temperature of something or the voltage or the range of something that was supposed to be, and just knowing all those specifics about the airplane was a bit of a game. You could challenge all the other pilots and we'd do fun things with that. So I think that really set the stage for the types of learning and the types of the attitude, I guess, maybe that you'd take when you do go learn a new airplane and you want to learn as much as you can about it because you want it to be a kind of a part of you. So it's the seat of the pants flying and knowing when something's not quite right. So you're prepared for anything.
Hmm. All right. Well, very good. Joe, we want to thank you again for coming on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Joe, of course, is a chief test pilot for Honeywell Aerospace. Joe, again, thank you so much. Where can people learn more about Honeywell and some of the things that company does?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you guys so much for having me on. And anybody can go for Honeywell products, they can go to aerospace.honeywell.com. You can check out all of Honeywell's information there on that website. And you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Duvall.
Oh, good. So you're on Twitter yourself. That's excellent.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Well, very good. Joe, it's been a real pleasure. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
All right, a little bit of what's up with the geeks. Max Trescott, what have you been doing lately up in the sky or related thereto?
Actually, reminds me a few months ago, I was at the local RC, remote control airplane flying club, and a new member came up to me who didn't know me and, just thought perhaps I was just somebody who only flew RC planes on weekends. And he said, "So what do you do when you're not flying?" And I said, "Well, eat and sleep."
That's all that's left.
and I guess create a podcast. Yeah, this weekend I was in Concord, California, teaching at the Cirrus Pilot Proficiency Program. This is a national program that was modeled on the Bonanza Triple P, Bonanza Pilot Proficiency Program, years ago, in which pilots fly in, bring in their airplanes. They spend all weekend going through a mix of ground school sessions, as well as some of them choose to fly with flight instructors. So I was one of the flight instructors. So I was busy flying on Saturday and Sunday with some of these pilots. It's kind of interesting. One of the simulator instructors there, they've got some really high-end simulators for the Cirrus, so people can elect to do that as well. Asked me afterwards, he said, "So, you know, tell me about the caliber of the, you know, the pilots that you're flying with. How do they compare with, you know, folks that you usually fly with?" And I told him, you know, it's kind of that same bell curve distribution you find anywhere. Some of the folks that fly with absolutely, you know, top of their game, outstanding, and some, boy, they need a lot of help. And part of the reason they're there is because they realize that they need a lot of help. So there's a, you know, wide mix of, you know, a range of capabilities there. But it's fun to kind of help the Cirrus community by, you know, lending my time and helping to teach there. And also I get to hang out with some of my other colleagues from around the country when we get together. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, it sounds like a blast. Wonderful, wonderful. Brian, how about you?
I need to give a shout out and an apology to Doug Padilla of Hangar 24. They had their air show this past weekend, and I was supposed to be there. And Doug did a whole bunch of special things for me to get me access to the air show and all. And Hangar 24 is also a great brewery. And unfortunately, I am going through treatment for skin cancer on my face, and it is not pretty right now. I look like basically a giant blister.
Oh my.
So I thought going out in public was a bad idea, and especially being out in the sun, out in Redlands, California, kind of the Inland Empire area. So I just wanted to note to Doug, you know, give him a shout out. You know, thanks for all the stuff, and sorry that I couldn't be there. And also, I wanted to give a shout out to Max Trescott for doing his other podcast. I was a little bit far behind in listening to it, and being a non-GA pilot, I actually find a lot of enjoyment in the podcast. And I recently purchased a house, and it's a 45-minute commute for me to get to this house. So I've been fixing it up, and I've been getting caught up on Max's episodes. So I've been listening to him back to back in the car, commuting back and forth. So just wanted to say, Max, you're doing a great podcast. And even for non-pilots, I find it phenomenally entertaining. So thank you so much for doing what you do.
Wow. Thanks so much for that kind endorsement of Aviation News Talk. I have a lot of fun doing it, and I'm amazed at the number of folks who send me all kinds of, you know, letters and comments and things along just those lines. So, yeah, it seems to be resonating with a lot of people. So I'm glad it's resonating even with non-flyers.
Yeah, I think that's a really cool thing. And aviation is such a broad topic. I mean, you know, you have a hobby or a business or a profession. Aviation is just too broad. But because of that, people tend to sort of specialize their interests in a slice of aviation. But one aspect of aviation that's always intrigued me, at least personally, is that it can be really interesting to learn about those other parts that, you know, you're maybe not so familiar with other parts of aviation. And I think that's why Aviation News Talk is such a joy to listen to. Besides Trescott, you've got this, you know, you got this smooth voice and this authority. You sound like you know exactly what you're talking about. And, you know, if I was going to take some flying lessons, I think I'd move to California and look you up for sure.
All right, you guys have me blushing. Hey, let me follow up on something else that Brian just mentioned, which was the skin cancer. And I had some skin cancer on my nose removed, I don't know, probably 10 plus years ago. And that is something that is of risk to pilots and also to skiers because of all the reflection off of the sun. So I'm just kind of curious, Brian, any thoughts as to, you know, I know you're up there at flight level 350 all the time, but you're not next to the window, I'm guessing.
No, I am. I'm actually next to the window. But I believe this was all caused when I was a kid growing up on the Jersey Shore, spending every moment on the beach, and most of those moments without sunscreen.
Ouch.
So it was years and years and years ago. And heck, who knew what sunscreen was way back then? Now I sound like I'm as old as Rob.
Yeah, it's funny. I've just started carrying it within the last few months. So whenever I'm out flying, I have a tube in my pocket. And I used to be very, you know, hit or miss as to whether I used it. Now it's like, no, you know what? I'm getting serious about it. So I only throw that out because I know there are other pilots listening. And all I can say is, you know, bring your sunscreen with you.
Good advice. Did you just say you got serious on it? Really, Trescott?
What did I say? What did I say I didn't catch?
You got serious on it.
Oh, serious. Yes, I got serious about it. Very, very good, Dave.
All right, David, anything in your world aviation-wise recently?
No. I'm the only one with a day job, remember?
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah. I will say that tickets are purchased for Friday. I will be seeing IMAX 3D. I will be seeing Solo.
There you go.
A Star Wars story. So I'm getting ready. I'm in a Star Wars kind of mode this week that, you know, Star Wars is out. And Patuxent River is coming up in three weekends. And I'm going to probably go down on Friday so we can talk to the Naval Laboratory about their drones. But most people, and then maybe I'll see a little bit of the show. And that's the same weekend as World War II weekend in Reading. So, and this year there's going to be two B-29s there. So I'm thinking maybe I'll hightail it up north for the afternoon to see Doc, who I haven't seen yet.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Yeah, I saw a B-29 this past weekend. I was up with Drone Mama at the New England Air Museum. We went up there for an event. They have some speakers. A series of speakers throughout the summer, I guess. We went up there for that, and I recorded a couple of interviews with a few folks, and you can look forward to those next episode, which is our traditional Memorial Day weekend bits and pieces episode. So look for that coming up. But we have a lot of recordings, and those that are still in the hopper, I think will put those into the bits and pieces episode in a week from now. But for this episode, we have another installment from student pilot Nikki. So let's listen to the continuing adventures of Nikki.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. Nikki here again. There comes a time when every mother bird kicks her bird out of the nest and makes sure it could fly. Today I'm going to discuss my very first solo cross-country. This wasn't the official two-airport cross-country. We tend to do a solo to one airport, then come back, and then the next time we do our two-solo airport, come back. So for my solo, I picked to go to St. Augustine. This is a city I drive to all the time. But I ended up flying to St. Augustine Airport, which is Kilo, Sierra, Golf, Juliet. And I knew the airport from the ground, but I've never actually flown there, except for one time with my flight instructor. This time was no different. It's pretty much kind of follow the coastline, keep the coast off your right wingtip on the way back, keep it off your left wingtip. It's hard to get lost in Florida. Always just keep the coast on one of your two wingtips. You tend to do fine. On the way there, I did flight following all the way there until I had the airport in sight, and then I contacted the airport. The tower had me actually vector back and forth and had me kept changing. He probably had me change my heading about six times, which I was like, are you trying to see if I know how to fly the plane or what is he doing? Then I realized he was probably just trying to create some space between me and the pilot in front of me without telling me to do a 360, because I did tell the tower I was a student pilot. On the approach, it was really nice. You come in over the channel, I made a left-hand base pattern into runway 31, made a fairly nice landing, and then the tower asked me to do something very interesting, which I had to scratch my head because I didn't know if it was correct or not. If you ever pull up St. Augustine Airport, it has three runways. It has runway 31 and then 130. And then it has two other runways parallel to it. And as of yet, I've never seen these two runways ever used. And my instructor said no one will ever probably use them. But when landing, once I came to a stop, the tower said, turn left at next intersection. And as I was looking in front of me, the first thing in front of me, well, it was another runway. It was runway 20. So I sat there for a second saying, well, do I turn left on 20 or do I go down to Bravo 2 and make a left-hand turn? I actually didn't know what to do. But I looked down the runway and I saw another aircraft taxiing down the runway. And I was like, okay, I guess it's okay to go ahead and taxi down 20, because then as soon as I made the left-hand turn, he said, go ahead and hold short of Bravo. That's the taxiway that was directly in front of us. So I'm basically sitting in the middle of this second runway. I'm like, well, there's no official hold short line, so I don't know where I'm supposed to stop. So I just made sure I was between Bravo and the runway. And I didn't get yelled at, so I just went ahead and did my pre-landing checks and everything, and then I got the airplane ready to take off to go back to my home airport. At which point, once I was ready, I went ahead and contacted ground and told them that I am holding short on runway 20 before Bravo, and I just waited for further instructions, and they went ahead and cleared me to taxi down Bravo, hold short of 24, to taxi to Bravo 6. I didn't even get a chance to get to 24 before they cleared me past 24 to Bravo 6. And then once I did that, I was number one to take off. Or pretty much, once I switched it back over to tower, they cleared me to take off immediately for departure to the south, back to my home airport. But the tower never officially told me to turn left on runway 20, so I never did find out if I actually should have turned left on 20 or went down to Bravo 2, which would have been the next official intersection. But I didn't get yelled at. I didn't get told to call the tower or anything. And my instructor said, once we debriefed and I was back, he said, Mel, next time ask the tower and they'll tell you yes or no. I was surprised, being a student pilot, the tower did not officially tell me to turn on 20, but maybe it's a normal thing at this airport. We'll see. I will be coming back to this airport at least two or three more times for my official solo cross country when I go to two different airports. This is Nikki saying goodnight.
All right. Thanks, Nikki.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Max T, what do you think happened there?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I would have, just like Nikki said she expected the tower would have said, you know, turn onto a runway if they expected her to turn onto a runway. So I'm kind of surprised. That may be perhaps kind of a local procedure there. And that's the thing. Different airports, you know, have inconsistent procedures from, you know, one to the next. And, of course, every airport's kind of unique. And so it makes sense sometimes for them to have different kind of procedures. But yeah, my experience has always been that if they want you to turn down a runway, they'll be pretty explicit about that. But I also totally agree with her flight instructor, which is, if in doubt, ask. I mean, you never, ever, ever want to assume. Controllers are always happy when pilots ask. They really hate it when, you know, pilots just assume and, you know, end up doing something different than they wanted.
Yeah, okay. Makes sense.
Hmm. All right. Brian, let's do one of the recordings from Planes of Fame air show that you recorded. You got a preference for which one we should put up now?
We should probably do the one from Breeze Anderson at Helistream, just to show that we still love helicopters here on Airplane Geeks Podcast. Also, I got permission to use his name. So Hudson Rhodes is the guy who... the audio engineer that cleaned up my disastrous recordings. So definitely want to thank Hudson for all the work that he put into cleaning up these recordings to make them usable for the show. So we'll do that. And Helistream is an interesting helicopter company, and they had a helicopter that reminded me of Shamu. It was so the helicopter was actually painted in the colors of an orca. And I thought that they were doing some promotion with SeaWorld or were partnering with Southwest because they have a orca painted aircraft, but they didn't. So I guess let's listen to what Mr. Anderson has to say about HeliStream. So here in the background, we have Sean D. Tucker flying in the Oracle plane, but I was walking along the flight line and came across a helicopter that is painted in the colors of Shamu and thought I'd stop in. And I've come across Breeze Anderson, who's the
flight instructor, the pilot for the helicopter.
Okay. And so HeliStream, can you tell me a little bit about what you guys do?
So HeliStream, our company, was founded in 1982 by a man named Rod Anderson and Barbara Perrin. We started off just simply providing flight training, Robinson R-22 helicopters, and over the years we've grown into a company that does multiple helicopter operations. We do everything from the basic flight training all the way up to now firefighting. We also work with utilities companies doing external load, power line patrols. We do the basic stuff, aerial tours, film work. You're welcome. We do virtually anything you can do in a helicopter, I think, in a facet that allows us to be multifunctional, I think, and have multiple roles.
Okay. I think many of our listeners will be familiar with firefighting from either the BA-146 or DC-10 or even 747, but firefighting through a helicopter, how's that getting accomplished?
It's a little more, I think, pinpoint accuracy than with those big birds. I've been fortunate enough to get to see those big birds dumping, and it's impressive. And they cover a lot of area when they do it,
right.
And they certainly carry a lot more of either flame retardant or water, whatever it is they're dropping, and they're probably much more effective. But we're able to use either a Bambi bucket or a belly tank on the helicopter, and actually work with the individual flight crew, or excuse me, ground crews, and be directed in a little bit more as to where they need us. And
so if there's a specific hot spot, you could do a pinpoint drop on that area.
And we're able to work with multiple different types of water sources, so as small as a swimming pool. So DC-10, you got to go back and get reloaded, right? So
so you could go poach some water out of a swimming pool?
We absolutely can. Or if there's even a ravine, we can drop the bucket in, you know, and lay it in the ravine and then drag it upstream until it's
right.
full. So we can work with a little bit more, more vigorous terrain, a little bit different water sourcing. So we certainly can't do what they do, but we can do a helpful role, and we can do it a little bit differently and effectively in different situations than they can.
And besides firefighting and general helicopter pilot training, what else do you do?
We do a lot of work with local utilities agencies. We do things such as human external cargo, something we recently got into, where we will work with the utility company, and we actually just acquired an H-145, which is a twin-engine helicopter, and we'll dangle a lineman from a long line, and then we'll bring him in either to the power line itself or the power pole that's needing work, and we'll hover above them and allow them to do their work. So something that's a new venture for us, but a really, really cool one as well.
And then do you do other commercial work? Like I've seen helicopters load air conditioners on the roof of a skyscraper, things like that?
We absolutely do. In fact, out here where we live, this is called the Inland Empire. We have buildings that are called tilt-up buildings, and they don't build them really, really tall, but they build them really, really long and really, really wide. So it's difficult for a regular ground-based crane to reach over, and sometimes it cannot even reach over to the middle of the building to mount these units. So they'll hire helicopters, our company in particular, we do quite a few of them, to actually put AC units on top of the buildings. And we can actually be so efficient and effective with it that we can oftentimes be cheaper than actually renting the crane and doing it.
Right.
So it works out pretty good.
Good job. And then you guys have multiple locations as well. So not only are you here at the Chino Airport, you have other locations in Southern California, right?
Yes, sir. Our main location is at John Wayne Airport. The address is 3000 Airway Avenue. It's a pretty neat and unique facility because we're actually located on a rooftop. So
really?
We actually, it's called Centerport, and it's been known as the world's largest privately operated heliport. So, and it's in a Class Charlie airspace. It's the only one of its kind in the country. So it's a pretty neat deal that we have out there. But we also have a office at Fullerton Airport. It's still a ground base with a hangar and normal aviation stuff. And we operate a satellite office out of San Diego Gillespie Field as well.
Okay. Thank you so much for spending some time and talking about the helicopter and your operations. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for listening to me.
All right, Brian. Thanks for recording that. We have some more coming up. I think we have a couple left that we'll pick up next week in the Bits and Pieces episode.
Yeah, we'll put them on the Bits and Pieces. One of the things he was talking about, though, with his external human cargo, just imagine being the guy on the long line being carried around on the helicopter to go work on a power line. That seems like a crazy job to me.
Yeah.
Well, and think about the stress it would put on the pilot, knowing that he or she were to screw up. Somebody's life may be in jeopardy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Just a quick shout out. We got an email from our friend Jamie Dodson, and he, of course, is the author of the Nick Grant Adventures series, and he has two short video promotional reviews that are on YouTube, one for Mission Shanghai and one for Black Dragon's Attack, and we'll put those in the show notes. You can take a look at them. They're not too long. They don't take up too much of your time. But give him a look, Nick Grant Adventures series by Jamie Dodson. All right, with that, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest was Joe Duvall. He's the Honeywell Chief Test Pilot. We really appreciate Joe being able to take the time to come and speak to us and all of you. As always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to send us an email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. There's other ways to get in touch with us. You'll find all of those on the website, airplanegeeks.com. You'll also find show notes there for every episode, including this one. But if you need to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's at airplanegeeks.com/504. Now let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And Brian Coleman, we will start with you.
Oh, people can usually find me at the club room at LAX. And if I'm not there, they can get a hold of me by sending an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com, since I'm still not being very social. And David, yes, every once in a while I do get on Slack.
Okay. And David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook on our Facebook page. And a shout out to Peter, who's doing a good job with the Airplane Geeks Facebook page.
He is.
And you can always find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, droning on the UAV Digest.
And Max Trescott, where do we find you?
Well, when I'm not on this podcast, I'm on another one, Aviation News Talk, and you can find it wherever you find podcasts. And I should mention, I don't know if I've told you guys, I've got two dedicated apps now that you can find in the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store. So just type in Aviation News Talk, and that makes it really easy to switch between episodes. And if you go to our homepage, aviationnewstalk.com, just click on Contact, send me an email, or if you have a question you want answered on the show, just click on Listener Questions.
Great. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Also look for me in LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, and also with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. Our intro music is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions. What he does is he takes aviation sounds and he incorporates them into pieces of music. You can find those at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.